challenge you on one of the statements that you made in the tail end of the campaign.
Here we go. That your question is a very political question because you have an agenda. You're CNN. You're fake news.
Are you concerned that you may have?
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax.
Are you?
That's enough. Put down the mic.
Quiet.
Can you stay, Mr. President-elect?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news,
sir. Fake news. I don't take questions from CNN. John Roberts of Fox. Let's go to a real network.
That's Jim Acosta. He's chief White House correspondent for CNN and one of his many confrontations with Donald Trump. When the President of the United States has demonstrably lied more than 10,000 times since he was elected, what's a reporter to do? Acosta's strategy has made him central to Trump's diatribes against fake news. On this podcast, Acosta tells me how he understands another phrase the President has used to describe the news media as a whole.
This expression, the enemy of the people, will help come to define this era when one group of Americans was pitted against another in ways that I've never seen before in my lifetime.
Acosta has now seized on Trump's attack line, The Enemy of the People, as the title of a book, subtitled A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. I asked him why he wrote it.
Well, you know, I wanted to write this book because I feel as though the public has a right to know what we've been up against as reporters covering this presidency, covering this administration. A couple of things. One is, as the Washington Post fact checker recently found, the president has uttered approximately 10,000 false or misleading statements since the beginning of this administration. That's made us fact checkers in real time. I think we've never been up against a challenge like that in terms of setting the facts straight in terms of what comes from the president of the United States. And so that's made for a very difficult and challenging environment. And then on top of that, I think the president has gone after the press in ways that are not healthy for our democracy, referring to the press as the enemy of the people and fake news and so on. I think it's really undermined the confidence of the American people in the free press in this country. And that's why I wanted to write this book, so folks understand what we're going through, that we are committed to delivering accurate, reliable information to the American people on a regular basis. And we do that in what is a very volatile, chaotic, and sometimes threatening environment. And so I hope that that this book will send that message that we are not the enemy of the people, but we are defenders of the people.
Your subtitle is Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is something I've never really experienced before as a journalist. I've been doing this for about 25 years. I've worked in several different local markets. I worked at CBS News. I now work at CNN. I've covered four presidential campaigns, and this is my second administration, and I've never seen this kind of volatile environment for journalists who cover a politician or any politician. I routinely cover Trump rallies where, you know, we have to have bodyguards go with us because of the environment that we've been put in. I receive death threats on a regular basis. Unfortunately, it's not something that I brag about or, think is a great thing. But I think the folks at home need to be aware of the fact that, you know, journalists who cover this president, reporters, news anchors who cover this president are doing it with something of a target on their backs. And it's unlike anything I've seen before in this business.
Throughout the book, you describe the president and his administration in very negative terms. You say he has damaged the presidency. You have said he's responsible for the degradation of our political culture. You talked about the Helsinki meeting as a shameful spectacle, a unique humiliation for the United States. You say we didn't really need the Mueller report to know there was collusion with Russia. His words are the height of hypocrisy from time to time. So you're using his own phrase as your title. Are you turning it on him? Are you saying he is the enemy of the people?
Well, I'm not really calling anybody the enemy of the people, but I think that when you use that kind of language, you certainly put people, I think, in a very dangerous situation. My concern is that we have a situation where a reporter is hurt or, God forbid, killed in this country. And at that point, we cross over into new territory. At that point, the United States joins countries around the world, not exactly a great list of countries, but countries around the world where the press is no longer safe doing its job. And I want folks to...
Okay, but wait a minute. Excuse me. You ducked my question.
Okay.
Are you calling the president the enemy of the people? Is that the intent of the title?
Oh, no. Let me just answer that emphatically. No, I am not calling the president the enemy of the people. But I do think, and I write about this in the book, that this expression, the enemy of the people, will help come to define this era when one group of Americans was pitted against another in ways that I've never seen before in my lifetime. No, the press is not the enemy of the people. As I write in the book, we are defenders of the people. And the reason why we're defenders of the people is because we're devoted to the people. We want to tell their stories. We want to get information that is relevant to their lives. We want to hold leaders accountable and hold their feet to the fire so the American people can know that they're getting their money's worth when they pay their taxes every year. That's the job of a free press in this country.
Okay, and so you're not calling the president the enemy of the people?
No, I just stated emphatically, I am not doing that. I suppose folks might, you know, take that away from the title, but that's not the purpose of this book. The purpose of this book is to shine a bright light at some of the rhetoric and some of the behavior that journalists have been subjected to, because in my view, and I say this, you know, very comfortable in the lane of a straight news reporter, that much of this behavior and rhetoric falls outside the bounds of what most folks consider to be normal presidential behavior.
Are you really still a reporter in the sense that you just described? When CNN went to court to prevent the Trump White House from revoking your hard pass, access to the White House, including the press briefings, and a ruling went in your favor, or it appeared to be going in your favor, you let off a little steam, you say, by shouting, "We beat Trump." Do you have, personally, do you have an essentially adversary relationship with the president?
Well, the press typically has an adversarial relationship with any administration. I mean, that
and should it? Is that?
Well, I think it is healthy. Yes, I think it's healthy to have somewhat of an adversarial relationship. You're not there to be their buddies and so on. We're there to report the news. And if you're doing it in a tough, aggressive way, obviously they're not going to see you as their friends. They're going to see you as you know, somewhat of an adversary. Do I want that to be the case? Do I relish that kind of relationship? No, I don't. But I do think, especially in this day and age, that it is very necessary to be aggressive and tough with this administration. When you have a president who consistently tells falsehoods on a daily basis, and I'm not saying that to, you know, take a shot at anybody. I mean, the data is there. When you have 10,000 false or misleading statements over the course of 2 years, that's just data that I'm pointing to. When you're in an environment where the president routinely calls reporters the enemy of the people, he hasn't just done that with me. He did that over the weekend with reports he didn't like in The Washington Post and The New York Times. And I just, you know, my sense of it is that we don't want to hand off to the next generation a country and a political environment where it's acceptable for leaders of this country, the United States government, to refer to the press as the enemy.
In terms of the way the history of the relationship has worked out, one of the things you accuse the White House and the president himself of doing is trying to control the message at press briefings and presidential appearances. But when did a president and his press aides not try to do that?
When did they not try to do...
Control the message.
Control the message. Well, my goodness, they've always tried to do that.
Sure.
I mean, that is the job of a White House press secretary, and that is the job of a White House communications director.
So
and
this I think is different, then?
This is different. And keep in mind, remember, we have not had a press briefing over at the White House in more than 90 days. I mean, that is something that we've been grappling with for some time now. You know, we used to have the White House press secretary go into the White House briefing room and take questions from reporters. And this, you know, this was not just the network reporters in the front row clamoring for questions. These would be reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, you know, wire services like the Associated Press and Reuters and foreign news outlets from around the world. That whole, that whole system has gone away. That system of delivering accurate, reliable information to the American people has gone away. That tradition has gone away. And unfortunately, I think the public is really disturbed by that. The taxpayers aren't being served well by all of that.
But let me ask you this. The press briefings, as you indicated, have always been an effort by the administration to control the message. Have they then been the source of accurate and reliable information, or has the news really come when you go out afterwards and say, wait a minute, here's what really happened, as contrary to what we were told today?
Yeah. Well, those briefings, I think the purpose of those briefings is supposed to be to provide the American people with important information. Unfortunately, what we've seen over the last two...
The president wants to get his line out.
Well, but remember, let me just, if I may,
sure,
add to what you're saying here. Yes, press secretaries traditionally come out and they spin and they tell us all sorts of things in terms of what the president is doing. But when there's a national crisis, when there's a natural disaster that's occurred, those questions have also been asked during White House briefings. And, we typically, when things were a bit more normal in the White House briefing room, would have the opportunity to ask about things on the national security front, relations with important U.S. allies and NATO allies and so on. All of that has gone away. And so the briefing is much more than just a sparring fest between correspondents in the front row and the White House press secretary. Traditionally, they've been an outlet for, some pretty important information to get out to the American people. And I think we've lost sight of that.
Okay. Certainly, it has been a sparring fest as far as you're concerned, and others as well. You're not the only one.
No, certainly. We've seen reporters, and we can go back to the days of Sam Donaldson, Dan Rather, all the way through the Clinton administration during the impeachment controversy there, and through the Iraq War when George W. Bush was in office. And listen, when Barack Obama was in office, there were times in the White House briefing room where, I got into some sparring with Jay Carney and Josh Earnest, the press secretaries there. But I think over the last couple of years, what we saw from Sean Spicer, the first press secretary, when he came out into that briefing room and essentially just lied to the public about the president's inauguration crowd size, that set a tone of dishonesty that I don't think they've been able to shake loose.
No one had numbers. This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
When the current outgoing White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders admits in the Mueller report that she passed on false information at one point regarding the firing of the FBI Director James Comey, I mean, that we've seen some pretty unprecedented dishonesty coming out of that White House briefing. My hope is that with the new press secretary coming in, that we can get back to the way we used to do things, where there perhaps wasn't as much sparring going on and more information provided to the people.
Something occurred to me as I was reading through the, particularly at the end of the book, where the press office backs away from revoking your hard pass and let you have it after all. And throughout the book, you cite Steve Bannon, you cite other people as well, as talking about a Trump strategy of destroying media credibility. And I'm wondering, did they suddenly realize at some point that you, having become a sort of celebrity in this regard, are a necessary foil for that strategy of destroying media credibility? Are you sort of playing Trump's game and providing exactly the target that he needs?
Well, I write about that in my book. And, folks have said, well, is this kind of a symbiotic, reality TV style relationship? It's not for me. For me, this is very serious business. And, we have to day in and day out, fact check this administration in real time. We have to ask the tough questions, regardless of, how the president wants to taunt and troll the media. And as I write in the book, yes, Steve Bannon, essentially says he and the president came up with this idea of bringing back the term the enemy of the people, which has, its roots in, autocratic and less free societies, Soviet Union and so on.
When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead.
Mr. President. Joseph Salen was one of the people you cite.
That's right. Bannon and Trump decided to start using it as a way to taunt and troll the press. And as I write in the book, it's rhetoric that's gotten out of their control. And you know, the president, for some extent, to some extent, does think of this as an act, or did at one point. As I write in the book, at one press conference in February 2017, he refers to me as very fake news. And then after that press conference is over, I got a call from Hope Hicks, one of his top aides. And she says, well, Jim, I just want you to know the president thought you were very professional today. And he said, Jim gets it. And I remember looking at my phone and thinking, what in the world is going on here? He just, you know, went off at me at this press conference, and now one of his top aides is telling me that he thought it was a good exchange. My sense of it is that this started off as an act, and it's just gotten out of control. When you look at what happened last fall, right before the midterms, when, you know, this self-described Trump supporter sent a pipe bomb to CNN and Democratic officials around the country. That to me, really crystallized the danger that I was concerned about all along covering this president and going back to the campaign, that somebody would absorb this hostility that we see on a daily basis out on the campaign trail and hear from this president on a regular basis and take things too far. And my concern is that while nobody was hurt last fall in that incident, that, you know, something terrible could happen if this kind of volatility and rhetoric continues.
I love the conversation with Hope Hicks and your astonished reaction to it.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that suggests, as I indicated before, as I've asked you about before, I made up my mind about this, that you have in some way allowed yourself to become a device for the White House, that they need you in order to help portray the press
right.
as negative and to help that
yeah.
strategy of destroying the credibility of the media.
Yeah, I think I'm an example of that potential for sure. But you take me out of the equation, you take me out of the picture. The president has gone after other reporters and other people who are in the news. He does this on a regular basis. You can just go through his Twitter feed, and he's tweeting about people he doesn't like in the news media or news outlets he doesn't like in the news media all the time. And I, you know, if you go through these tweets, I represent a tiny fraction of the folks that he's gone off on over the course of the last 2 years of this administration. So he does see the press as something of a foil, something of a device. But the question becomes, and I write about this in the book, I call it a game of what would you do? Now, what do you do in that point? Do you say, well, that's true, he's using us as a foil, he's using us as a device, as a sparring partner, I guess that means we just shouldn't do our job anymore. No, we can't do that. We can't, my goodness, what kind of world would we be living in? What would our collective sense of the truth and reality be if we just reported what the president said and put out his tweets on a regular basis without any fact-checking? What would our sense of the truth and reality be if we just allowed Sarah Sanders to come into the White House briefing room, say what she has to say, and not challenge what she is telling the American people? When we hear whopper after whopper after whopper in the White House briefing room or at these press conferences, and reporters just sat there like potted plants and did nothing. It's certainly not just me, and I tip my hat to a lot of folks throughout this book, other reporters at other news outlets who, you know, very aggressively try to interject and say, hold on, Mr. President, hold on, press secretary, what you said is not true. And yes, I suppose Trump supporters and the president's advisors and so on may look at that dynamic and say, wow, this really works well for us. But my sense of it is that we have to keep doing our jobs regardless of that dynamic. We have to keep, aggressively pursuing the truth regardless of that dynamic. And as I write in the book, we're not just here to report the news these days. We're here to defend the truth.
I think nobody can deny the 10,000 false statements that have been made by the White House, as illustrated, as counted up by the Washington Post and others as well.
Yeah.
But as regards the performances in the press briefings, you're not a tiny fraction of that. You, in fact, have made yourself a special target. You've become a celebrity as a result of the exchanges you've had directly with the president, directly with the press secretary, more importantly, with the presidency himself. And I'm just wondering at what point that becomes something that compromises your own ability to report in a way that is credible about the president. You're still the chief White House correspondent for CNN. And have you put yourself in a position where you've allowed yourself to become an example for people who are supportive of Trump to say, wait a minute, you know, they're all just like Jim Acosta. They just want to get in a fight with the president, and they want to claim victories when they beat him in court. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that there are going to be critics on all sides. One of the things, and I write about this in the book, that I'm gratified by is that I hear on a regular basis from folks who are very happy with the work that we do over at CNN. They saw a situation over the last couple of years where there wasn't really a check on the executive branch of the United States government. And the press really became that check, that balance that the founders intended to have. And so, for example, I talk about this a lot in the book. You know, I'll wake up on a plane and look at a note sitting there left by the flight attendant from the pilot saying, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Thanks so much for what you do. When I, you know, went back and forth with Stephen Miller over immigration policy, an Indian family stopped me on the street right outside the White House and said, thank you so much for standing up for America's immigrant story. There has been moment after moment, episode after episode, where we've heard from so many wonderful people across the country who are very happy with the work that we're doing over here at CNN. And I have to say, a lot of my colleagues across the press corps are hearing much of the same thing. There are Americans out there who are, yes, on the Trump side of things, who are frustrated with the coverage. But, what I ask them to think about, think deeply about, is whether or not we want to have a situation in this country where the press doesn't really check what the president has to say on a daily basis. My goodness, the Republicans aren't going to stay in power forever. Do folks want a situation where a Democratic administration comes in and says, well, Donald Trump did all of these things, we're going to start doing these things too, and we're going to do it to advance Democratic interests and a Democratic agenda? Folks, the way things work in this town, you don't get to stay in power forever, and life's not so great when the shoe's on the other foot. That is the response that I have, and I tell folks at Trump rallies all the time, because I spend a lot of time talking to these folks. I find it to be really important to
you take to a lot of abuse at those Trump rallies.
I want to talk to them too, and I tell folks, we're not here just to do the news for the Republicans. We're not here to do a commercial for the president. We have to do the news for everybody.
So it's gratifying, obviously, when you get that kind of response from the pilot on the plane or anybody else. But is that an illustration, though, of how polarized we are as a society rather than just an endorsement of what you and others are doing with regard to President Trump?
It's a deeply polarizing time, but I don't think it has to stay this way. When I talk to Trump supporters at the rallies, and there's a whole section about this in my book, you know, I had one lady come up to me in Columbia, South Carolina, and she said, you know, Jim, you just need to stop asking those questions of the president and Sarah Sanders. We're going to have another civil war. We're going to have people start shooting one another. And I thought to myself, my God, is that where we're heading right now? This is not good. I had another person come up to me and essentially ask me, you know, whether George Soros is paying me to ask the questions that I ask. I had another gentleman ask me if the CIA was paying me to ask the questions that I ask. And I had to say, no, sir, no, ma'am. I'm not working for the CIA. I'm not working for George Soros. And you know, I write about all this in the book, not to poke fun at folks, but I want folks to understand that these are your fellow Americans, and there are folks consuming so much media these days, so much information these days that is not delivered by the traditional mainstream media, and it's really leading people in the wrong direction. And, you know, my concern is that we have folks out there who have, you know, I guess, given up on getting their information from folks like us, and I'd love for them to give it another thought and reconsider, because, you know, an uninformed populace, as we've seen throughout our history, is a dangerous thing. And, you know, we're starting to see elements of that here in this country. When I go to Trump rallies and I see Q signs and people talking about Pizzagate and these wild false conspiracy theories, it's evidence to me, anecdotal, I suppose, but it's evidence to me that there are a lot of folks out there who are getting their information from what I would consider to be questionable sources.
What does this say about the traditional mainstream media and how good a job they have or have not done over the years? I think of the war in Iraq, for example, where it was presented by the administration and its supporters that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course they weren't there at all. Is it valid to go back and say that the mainstream media haven't been doing that great a job for a long period of time, and consequently people have been justly and skeptical about what they have heard?
Well, I think folks should be skeptical, and I think they should be tough on us, and news organizations are supposed to be accountable to people. We issue corrections, we issue clarifications when we make mistakes, when we fall short of perfection. This is not a perfect science. But as I write in the book, there have been moments throughout our history where, and you know, we were talking earlier about staying in your lane and so on. Remember when Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam, the legendary CBS News anchorman, went to Vietnam, came back and said the war in Vietnam can't be won. It's a stalemate. And Lyndon Johnson said, well, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost middle America. Walter Cronkite at that time was the most trusted man in America. There have been times when the press, when you know, notable figures in the press have had to tell the American people the painful truths. And, you know, I don't relish that. But, for example, when I got into it with the president over Charlottesville, and the president said to me in response to one of my questions that there were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
I had to say, Mr. President, there aren't any fine people in the Nazis. And, you know, as I write in the book, the president of the United States, it pains me to say this, I don't enjoy saying this, equivocated over white supremacist violence in Charlottesville. And, you know, as I write in the book, there aren't two sides to a story when it's a matter of right versus wrong. My goodness, am I supposed to go out there and say, well, maybe there were very fine people on both sides? There weren't. There were people like Heather Heyer, the counter-protesters in Charlottesville, and then you had white supremacist and neo-Nazi people on the other side. And, you know, when the president went to Helsinki and said that he believed Vladimir Putin over the U.S. intelligence community, what are we supposed to do? Say, well, maybe Vladimir Putin has a point. No. As journalists, we have to look at the situation very coldly, very clinically, and say, you know, that was one where the president probably, you know, did not rise to the level that we expect from an American president.
You call it a shameful spectacle and a unique humiliation for the United States.
Well, and as I wrote in the book, when he came back, Kellyanne Conway told me the president did not realize that he had made this huge blunder. And that was when they had to go about, you know, sort of correcting the record for the president there. And so, you know, Kellyanne Conway throughout this book is pretty candid in a couple places. She says she regrets saying alternative facts, that was a mistake.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts?
She disagrees with the practice of separating children from their parents down at the border. And she doesn't agree with using the term the enemy of the people. And as I write throughout the book, there are top officials inside that administration who will speak to us privately, but sometimes publicly, to say, wait, you know, well, maybe we don't have all of our ducks in the row all the time. And my experience has been covering this White House over the last couple of years, and I write about this in the book. It's a pretty chaotic environment behind the scenes. And the person who is in the center of that chaos is the president. I had a senior White House official tell me one time, he rules by instability. He makes everything around him unstable, so he's in control of the chaos. And so, you know, listen, it would be great if we could just call balls, strikes, and outs. But we're also here, I think, these days to call fouls. And that's an important role of the press in this era, I think, perhaps now more than ever.
People often say we're supposed to be objective. I don't think we can. We have to be fair. Are you still comfortable being the chief White House correspondent? Can you be fair, given your adversarial role and the one you take in your book, to the president?
I absolutely can, and I feel passionately about the job that I do on a daily basis and the importance of the task at hand for all of us at CNN and across the White House press corps. I write about this in the book. I want to hand off to the next generation, just like any other American, a country that's better than the one that we found. And that means a strong free press in America. And whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Trump supporter, or a lady in a pink resist T-shirt, I think that's a value that we can always rally around, that here in the United States, a strong free press will always help us remain free.
Jim Acosta, Onward and Upward. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
So we've talked about the news and the relationship between the president and the White House press corps. We'll be back in a moment and talk more on To the Point about what the Rand Corporation calls truth decay. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point. The struggle between President Trump, Jim Acosta, and the White House press corps is a dramatic example of the changing nature of news. It's been going on for a long time, from print to broadcast to cable TV, now to digital media. Last month, Michigan's Republican Congressman Justin Amash told a town hall he was advocating impeachment based on negative information in the 400-page report by Robert Mueller. Here's the reaction of one constituent, Kathy Garnett, who was in the audience.
I was surprised to hear there was anything negative in the Mueller report at all about President Trump. I hadn't heard that before, and I mainly listened to conservative news, and I hadn't heard anything negative about that report, and President Trump had been exonerated.
Of course, the report did not exonerate Trump. Mueller himself has been at pains to make that clear. So let's turn now to the Rand Corporation and its ongoing study of what it's defined as truth decay and how it impacts American life. Jennifer Cavanaugh is senior political scientist. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've talked a lot in your current report about opinion-based content. Have we just heard a result of opinion-based content?
Well, I think the example you just gave shows two things. I think one is the fact that opinion does drive a lot of news information now. And the other is that we have an increasing number of news choices, which means that people are really free to select the types of news that they want to read or watch or consume in some other way. And that allows us to filter or select our news so that it can give us kind of a skewed worldview. Motivated reasoning and our cognitive biases mean that we like to be right and we like to hear things that confirm what we already believe. And so there's a tendency among most people to seek out information and news sources that provide them information that is confirmatory. And that can lead to the situation in which we only get one side of the story.
So it seems to me what we're talking about is multiple definitions of what is news.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the study that we just published a couple months ago looks specifically at whether or not we can measure how news presentation is different across platforms. And we did that in a very empirical way, and we show that there are very clear differences in the way news is presented. It's the same basic information, but it's presented in a really different way with different points of emphasis and really different frames. And so it provides a very different product depending on which type of platform, whether you're getting your news from print or from cable news or from an online source.
Well, you say it's the same basic information, but is it? When we hear Kathy Garnett saying she thought Trump had been exonerated, when in fact Mueller himself says Trump was not exonerated.
Well, I think this goes back to what I said at the beginning of there being two issues there. The first issue is this issue of filtering and our ability to consume only that news information that we want to hear, and that can give us a very skewed worldview. And then there's the issue of opinion proliferating and spreading through all news sources on both sides of the political spectrum and any perspective that you're coming at it with. And so this specific report that we did this year was really focused on understanding news presentation across the board rather than looking at the partisan difference or difference across specific ideological divides.
So what do you mean by measurement? How do you measure this?
So what we did was we collected textual data, so newspapers, television transcripts, and online journalism, and we use a tool called RandLex, which we developed here at Rand. The tool is a textual analysis software, and it allows us to analyze this textual data. We have 121 different characteristics that we can look at in terms of understanding the tone and the style and the word choice. We can look at patterns of words and words that are used together. We can look at how often words are used. We can look at ambiguity and emotion, and we're able then to compare across over time. So we can look at pre-2000, post-2000, for example, and we can compare across platforms. So we can compare print to online, print to television, things like that.
What's the importance of that line, 2000?
Well, we chose the year 2000 because 2000 was the point at which the internet really achieved widespread use. So it passed that tipping point where almost everybody had access or an increasing number of people had access. So that's what we chose. There's also a number of other events you could point to in terms of changes in the media ecosystem, the rise of cable news, and other changes that really affected how we consume and share information.
How different is what we hear on electronic media or what we read there, and newspapers?
It's actually very different. We looked over time, so we looked at newspapers over time, and we also compared newspapers to print, newspapers to online, excuse me. We really didn't find very much difference when we looked over time in terms of how print newspapers have changed, but we found a big difference when we compare print to online journalism. In the print journalism, we see something that's much more traditional reporting. So who, what, where, when, and why. You have events, you have context, you have references to time, references to authorities. So you have this kind of context base. And when you're looking online, you have something that's much more subjective, much more opinion-based, personal perspective, rather than telling an objective story. You're hearing one person's personal perspective or the perspective of a specific segment of individuals. And there's often advocacy or argumentation trying to convince the reader to take your point of view. So to give you an example, if you were going to read a story about drug use and you read it in online and in print journalism, you might get a lot of statistics, a lot of data, a lot of information about how the problem has changed over time, defining the problem, who's involved in solving the problem. And in the online source, you might see something, the story of one clinic or drug use in a specific town or in a specific family. So it's a very personal context of providing the same sort of information. So you're getting a similar story, but it's told in a very different way and packaged with much different contextual information.
Just to use the example you gave as a hypothetical, when the online narrative is structured the way it is, does it just simply leave out the statistics, or does it sometimes try to incorporate them?
No, it will often incorporate them, but it will incorporate them as it relates to whatever the specific individual context is. So, you know, that's one thing that we definitely saw in the analysis. And other times, the statistics are left out, and that's one of the ways in which the two mediums are very different and not supplements for each other at all, or not replacements for each other. If you get statistics and kind of this broad general information from some sources and very individualized personal stories in the other, if you're only focusing on the personal stories, you can miss out on that broader context.
Even in the era of print, people used to say that don't just read one newspaper, read more than one in order to get the full story. And when broadcast began, I know Walter Cronkite and others used to say the same thing. Don't just take us from us, be sure to read the newspapers. You're suggesting that if you really wanted to get a well-rounded, comprehensive account of anything, you'd have to read multiple different kinds of media.
Yes, that's exactly one of the key takeaways from the report for information consumers, is that if you think that print and cable news and online journalism can be used in place of each other, that you can switch one for the other, that's really not the case. They really are very different forms of information, and they're providing you very different details. And if you want to get a full understanding of a story, not only do you need to read multiple newspapers to get several different perspectives and make sure you're not being swayed by bias, but you also need to be looking across platforms to look at the different ways of framing a story so that you make sure you have kind of the full context, the full set of details, and the full framing that applies to that issue.
You talked about measurements and the 121 characteristics that you applied, and I presume that you used software in order to do that. Did you also talk with reporters?
We have talked with reporters throughout this project to try to understand how they feel that journalism has changed. And, you know, I think that our results were pretty consistent with their expectations. I do think, though, that some of the stability that we found in newspapers and also in broadcast television was surprising both to us and to the reporters that we talked to. I think that there is some sense in which we feel like things have changed a lot in the news environment, and it's difficult for us just from a qualitative perspective to disentangle the changes over time and the changes that have occurred because we have so many different types of sources of information now. But really, the report drove home for us that the changes that we're seeing or the changes that we feel or perceive in the news that we're getting are really driven by these cross-platform differences.
So it's really all about tech, or not all about, but it's certainly in large part about technology.
It is in a large part about technology because, you know, the different types, the way in which information is framed on each of these platforms, if you think about why it might be framed that way, it makes sense based on the technology that we're using. We would expect television and cable news to be much more conversational and much more expository and oral because of the format. And we would expect things that are read online, meant to be read on a mobile phone, to be shorter, to be more personal, to be kind of quick hits. So a lot of these changes are driven by changes in technology that have then changed the way that information is produced and the way that it's shared and consumed.
Have you done research or do you intend to do research into how these changes and these different media are used by different news makers, whether it be the President of the United States or the Russians who want to mess with our elections?
So I think that's the next stage of this project. The first thing we wanted to be able to do was to measure the differences. We didn't want to have to be talk in generalities or in qualitative terms. We really wanted to be able to measure and put numbers on things and rank things and say this change is bigger than this change and understand specifically what was happening. But I think the next step is to understand the implications of these differences that we've been able to measure. One set of implications are the implications that you raise, which are different platforms or different types of information more easily used in various contexts, whether it's to spread disinformation or to manipulate information or to influence people. And then the second piece looks at it from the user's perspective, which is to think about whether or not these different forms of news presentation affect how people interpret news. So am I, as an information consumer, more susceptible to bias or more susceptible to disinformation when I'm reading it in the way online journalism presents news versus when I'm reading it in a newspaper? And so those are kind of the two follow-on questions that we're hoping to investigate going forward.
Are you suggesting that newspapers, print in general, and broadcasters as well, are in fact less biased than what we see online?
Well, you know, we didn't measure bias or intent or content in terms of what we looked at here. We were really looking specifically at the types of language that are used. So we'd need a different methodology to look at bias. What I'm suggesting is that different ways of presenting information, whether it's emotion or personal perspective or different levels of ambiguity or certainty or different uses of time references and references to public authorities, that different framings of news stories may affect how I interpret them. So I may be better at distinguishing between biased information and objective information when I see it in kind of the language of newspaper journalism rather than when I see it in the language of cable journalism. So it's understanding how we process that information, which is a kind of a follow-on question.
Can you take an example yet, such as the controversy over vaccines, for example, and compare the way it's covered in the New York Times, let us say, or the Washington Post or one of the other papers, as opposed to the way it's covered online?
Something that we could do if we could find two stories that were close enough or two sets of stories that were close enough, we could certainly look at that. And we did that. You know, we do see that in coverage of the drug issue specifically and of other kind of public policy and social issues. We do see this change. An example would be homelessness. You know, we can see examples of where homelessness is presented kind of in a much more statistical, straightforward way with details details and objective information versus a narrative account of storytelling, which is what we would see in kind of new media or in some of the later forms of broadcast television or newspapers, which is rather than giving me that objective information, providing me a narrative, a story of one homeless child or one homeless family. So those are the types of changes that we saw, and we really saw them across issues.
So depending then on what technology you rely on the most, you can come up with a very different conclusion, I presume, about whatever stories you're reading. That has real-world consequences in terms of politics and policy.
Yes, I mean, I think that we want to be able to confirm that when we, you know, if I read the objective account and when I read the personal account, do I come away or make decisions? Do I make the same decision regardless? I think we ultimately want to understand how these different forms of news presentation affect what I believe and then how I act on those beliefs. I think you're right that most likely we will come away with different ideas and we probably will act differently. And then that does have real consequences and real policy implications. And we're interested really in the next phase of this project in digging into those implications and trying to understand specifically what changes and how significant are those changes in beliefs or behaviors so that we can understand what might be the best way to combat those changes if they are leading us down a misleading or incorrect path.
You said at the outset there are just so many different news sources now. Let me ask you which ones you used. You had 3 newspapers, 5 TV channels, and several digital publications. List them. Tell our listeners which ones you used.
In the report, we used 3 newspapers. We looked at New York Times, Washington Post, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Our choices of newspaper sources were driven largely by availability. We wanted to have like 30 years of data. We went back to the 80s in order to get that type of information in a textual form, not PDFs, in a cheap way. Those were the 3 sources that we could do most efficiently. For television, we were able to look pretty broadly at the full set of available television options. So we have the 3 major network stations, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And then we looked at the 3 major cable channels as well, MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN. And then for online journalism, we had 6 sources, 3 on the right, 3 on the left. So we had Politico, Huffington Post, Breitbart, BuzzFeed News, The Blaze, and
The Daily Caller.
The Daily Caller, that's right.
So you had quite a range of political views there. I'm interested, what differences did you see between broadcast and cable, since you turn on the set and they both look the same?
Well, so we actually found pretty significant differences. As I said, like the cross-platform differences are really the most significant. If you're looking at broadcast television, you see something that's much more similar to newspaper journalism than is the case with cable news. So you see event references, time references, context. You do see much more of the traditional style of reporting when you look at broadcast news. When you look at cable news, you see something that looks pretty different. It's very conversational. It's argumentative. It's expository, so you have a lot of oral cues and dialogue. There's a high degree of emotion across the spectrum of emotions, negative and positive. There's personal perspective. It's very interview-based. So you do see kind of a very strong shift when you compare broadcast to cable news in terms of the change from something that it looks much more like what we think of when we think of traditional news to something that's much more of an interactive experience.
We, of course, are speaking on a podcast, which is a different kind of medium, but it is the product of a radio station. You haven't mentioned radio.
No, we really did want to look at radio, but we had trouble finding a good source of a sufficient number of radio transcripts going back far enough in time. So we were unable to look at radio in this project, and that was disappointing to us because I think radio is a really important form of a way that people get their news. It's actually, you know, we have other work going on under the Truth Decay umbrella that looks at media use, and we do find that podcasts and radio is a really significant source for people. So we were disappointed, and it's something that we hope to do in the future. We're continuing to explore options.
Your overall project is called Truth Decay. That certainly suggests that things aren't as good as they used to be. Is that an appropriate conclusion to draw?
Well, I mean, I do think that we argue in the first book that we are seeing this change between, you know, since about 2000, this change in the way that facts, data, and analysis are used in political and civil discourse and in the policymaking process. And we point to in the first book a number of different metrics that we can look at for how these things are changing over time. And so in that sense, you know, I do think that we are seeing something that does seem to be getting progressively worse. Now, one thing that we'd like to do in follow-on work is try to understand whether the rates of change of these changes that we observe in the way news is presented are accelerating or slowing down. So is the gap between cable news and broadcast television or online journalism, print journalism, are those gaps getting bigger faster than they were, say, 5 years ago? That's something that we'd like to look at because it's in a really important metric.
When you say things are getting progressively worse, you're making a value judgment, obviously, and you're suggesting that print and the manner in which material is presented there is, in fact, more reliable than what we're seeing now online, particularly. Do you think that's right? And are people less well informed as a result?
So when I said progressively worse, I was really referring to the first book, which looks specifically at the use of facts and data. And I do think that we can point to many different areas where facts and data are increasingly pushed aside in favor of anecdotes and personal experience. In terms of news presentation, I don't know that things are getting worse. They're just changing. And we're pretty careful in the book to not place value judgments on whether the changes that we observe in news presentation are getting better or are good or bad. In the first book, in this first project, we're really just trying to understand how have things changed. In the next project, what we hope to do is get into some of those implications that we talked about previously to try to understand whether or not those implications are good or bad, or whether it is having a negative or adverse effect on our ability to act on accurate information, our ability to get accurate information, and how well informed we are as a result. So I think that placing of a value judgment is something that we're hoping to do in the next phase.
But you are raising questions, it seems to me, about what is truth and what isn't truth. And we've seen already the members of the Trump administration suggesting that, you know, one person's facts aren't another person's facts. We don't seem to have a consensus anymore as to what truth is. Is that part of what you mean when you say truth decay?
Yeah, I mean, our first book looks at the impact or what happens when we don't have a common shared set of facts. And we distinguish between facts and truth because, you know, there's a longstanding debate about what is truth and can we ever know truth that's philosophical that we didn't want to get into. And so we're focused on facts, on whether or not we can agree on a set of facts that we can all objectively verify. And I think that we have many examples of ways in which this common set of facts does seem to be eroding.
Okay, the study is ongoing. This is one part of it. It's called Truth Decay, and we've been talking with Jennifer Kavanaugh. Great to have you on our program, and thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoy talking with you.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody with production assistance from John Reed, our engineer, Chuck Prevedere. The To The Point Climate Change Update asks this question. If you plan on flying anywhere this summer, have you considered your carbon footprint? There are alternatives to jet planes. You can even buy carbon offsets. On social media, you can tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave us a review or contact me directly at warren.olney@kcrw.org. That's O-L-N-E-Y. I want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Join us next week, and thanks again for listening.